you know, your kid asks, why is the sky blue? Or could it ever rain Coke? You know, don't give them the answer or don't pull it up on your phone real quick. It's, gee, I don't know. Let's figure that out together. Let's explore it together.
The Life in Motion podcast is brought to you by Actual Outdoors. They help build beautiful brands that highlight the approachable and authentic parts of outdoor recreation. Said simply, they keep it real. Learn more at actualoutdoors.com.
This is a Life in Motion audio experience, a podcast about travel, action sports, culture, and more.
What's up, and welcome to episode 201 of Life in Motion. I've got Aaron with me from the South Yuba River Citizens League, who are all about uniting their community to protect and restore the Yuba River watershed. I'm excited to hear his story and what they're doing to make an impact. Aaron, thanks for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm excited to dive in into what all that you all are doing. It sounds like you got some really cool and unique kind of initiatives that you're doing and impact as well. But before we kind of dive into that aspect of it, let's kind of start things off with, you know, who you are, where you're from, kind of what got you into the outdoors in the first place, kind of leading to where you're at today.
Yeah, absolutely. So grew up in kind of rural Northern California, small community in Humboldt County, kind of just before you start going up into the Sierra Nevada, up, you know, or the Trinities up there. And grew up outside, playing outside, you know, surfing, running around the creek behind my house, that kind of thing. And so being outside, outdoors, has always kind of been part of who I am and what I've done. And that combined with parents who sort of encouraged curiosity, encouraged sort of a scientific way of exploring the world, as well as some great teachers, you know, sort of at an early age set me on the trajectory to kind of where I am today. You know, the short version is I spent about a decade long seasonally as a whitewater raft guide. I spent some time working as a ski patroller. So a lot of kind of outdoor rec focused jobs. Eventually I decided to go back to school to actually finish my bachelor's degree for, you know, any parents that are nervous about their kids that might be listening. From graduating high school to actually getting a bachelor's degree took 8 years and 4 different schools. So don't worry about it. People have to find their own path. After that, once I sort of discovered the subject of geography in this way of kind of exploring the world, asking kind of scientific questions of natural processes and the environment with a spatial lens, I got kind of pretty hooked on school. Finished a bachelor's degree, went to University of Denver for a master's degree, and then did a PhD at the University of Oregon, the whole time studying rivers, which has been this kind of theme throughout my life, spending time on water, on rivers, and research really focused on what are the interactions and what are the sort of implications in channel form and then habitat function based on human activity. So whether that's, you know, for my master's degree, as simple as just kind of the action on really popular commercial runs, dragging rafts up a beach and then dragging them back down to breach day after day, trip after trip, and how sort of that the sand that is naturally deposited gets dragged into the river. And then my PhD was really looking at on larger scales, looking at how things like bridge abutments, how levees, tributaries, history of mining impact channel form, and then kind of habitat, and looking at sort of large scales, so 100 plus miles of river, and then at sort of at a very fine spatial scale. And then, you know, how I ended up here at the South Yuba River Citizens League, affectionately referred to as CIRCLE, was as I was finishing grad school, I had some great opportunities to do some research and work on some really cool projects, but the ones that got me the most excited were the ones where there was restoration work being done, there was monitoring being done, and there were community organizations that were kind of trying to own that work. And so as I sort of thought about my future and careers, there's certainly appeal to academia and the research world, but I really liked seeing work get done. I really liked seeing kind of positive changes happen. And so that's what initially drew me to CIRCLE. was a position where I started, which was managing all of our lower Yuba River restoration projects.
That's awesome. And it's definitely quite a story. So it's funny, you mentioned the college thing, taking you 8 years to get the bachelor's, but then, going on to get your master's, PhD, all that stuff. So as you mentioned or led with that, there's hope as well. You just got to find your own way. But so one thing I wanted to circle back to a little bit, you mentioned kind of growing up and obviously a lot of exploring outside and that kind of stuff, but your parents, it sounded like kind of, encouraged kind of the scientific way of exploring. Were they teachers or what are some examples of that? Because it almost sounds like that's sort of where that kind of might have gotten instilled a little bit. And then it slowly came out, further once you got older.
Yeah, they certainly weren't teachers by trade, although I think they both enjoyed that. I know they both enjoyed some of that education. And I think they both had some of that background personally. So my mom was an RN, family practitioner, and so certainly sort of a scientific background, understanding, science is a way of exploring the world, not a dogma or a belief system, but rather just a way of asking the question why, and then kind of in a structured way trying to find that answer, the answer to that question. And my dad's just a curious person, and so a lot of it was growing up fishing for steelhead with my dad, going backpacking, going hiking, spending time outside camping. And so there's that outdoor love of nature. And then I think it was for both of them, just really, encouraging asking questions. Some of those earliest memories for me are, even in third grade, I had a wonderful third grade teacher. And between her and my parents, at the school that I was at, I was technically too young to enter the science fair. But my folks and Ms. Bean, my teacher at that time, said, well, you're curious. I had this, this question, could it ever rain Coke? If all of the oceans and all of the rivers, everything Coke, is that what would rain? And so they were like, well, let's figure it out. That's a great question. And obviously it doesn't take too much research, even back then, opening up the encyclopedia to answer that question. But the experiment is fun and the process is fun. And that's where knowledge and exploration happens. And so, those are some of those earliest memories that I've got of encouraging that approach to exploring the world, and then it's the practical skills of, okay, well, how are we going to answer this question? Well, we're going to build a still and we're going to boil Coke. Well, that was interesting. Let's try milk. Let's try all of these other different things. And that really instilling that kind of encouraging that curiosity, and then the education for, how do we answer those kinds of questions?
Yeah, that's cool. So I'm assuming that it didn't rain Coke.
It does not rain Coke. No, evaporation only takes pure water. It's why, the oceans are salty as well. By the end of the sort of fun experimentation stage, we were distilling, not to be too gross, but distilling urine, and you get pure drinking water. It was rather flavorless. Actually, from a flavor standpoint, we appreciate some salts and some minerals in our water.
Interesting. I did not know that. So there we go. Some more fun facts there. But no, that's really cool. Having your parents and the teachers, everything like that, kind of encouraging the different way to sort of look at the outdoors and nature, and kind of instilling that in you in a young age. And of course, you mentioned kind of navigating or kind of heading towards whitewater rafting, guiding, and skiing and that kind of stuff, which is like the more recreational aspect of the outdoors. But it sounds like in that time, you're probably also enjoying teaching others as well how to enjoy the outdoors as you were, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There was certainly education there from guiding rafts, and just that kind of, you get a group of people in your boat and you got to teach them how to paddle, teach them how to sort of follow commands, teach them how to do all of the things that come with running a whitewater river. But also you need to build rapport, and you got to go from, I've never met these people and they're strangers, to they trust me to get them down the river. And as you start guiding harder and harder whitewater, you have to trust them, because, as soon as you get to hard class 4, class 5 whitewater, you know, your health and safety is as much in their hands and their ability to paddle the boat and do what you say and follow those commands as their safety is in your hands as the guide. And so, yeah, that kind of quick teaching, quick personal connection stuff was, you know, between guiding and ski patrol. That's where those skills develop. Wouldn't trade those experiences for anything. I'd rely on those skills daily.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And it's cool, you know, that you have the two different perspectives of the outdoors, like as mentioned, from the recreational aspect, but also kind of the scientific aspect of it as well. So, you know, you got your bachelor's, you did your master's, PhD, all that stuff. And then you mentioned, you know, obviously enjoyed that because, you know, you went that far kind of within that field. And then, you know, stumbling upon Circle and everything that that they're doing, mainly you mentioned because of the impact. So what is the story, like, I guess the history a little bit behind the organization, and then like kind of from the beginning phases when you first got involved, like what were some of those specific kind of impactful things that you saw them doing that you were like, hey, you know, I can get in, I can lend a hand, and you know, we can make some progress on these projects.
Yeah, absolutely. So Circle's been around for a little over 40 years now. And it started as a group of people in the Nevada City, Grass Valley, California area that were really concerned about the proposal for a couple of new dams on the South Yuba, which is a gorgeous, gorgeous stretch of river. And so the organization was founded to fight those proposed dams. Ultimately successful, and then went a step further, and there's now about 40 miles of state wild and scenic river. The South Yuba is a wild and scenic river, in addition to being a phenomenal whitewater paddling river. And so from there, the organization kind of continued to grow. We've got a film festival, the Wild and Scenic Film Festival, that we host and then send out on tour, and it's really about inspiration and kind of taking our message and collecting films that share that message and getting them out to, so other folks are inspired to see stories of success across the world, and then try to kind of take that into their own community. We do Lower Yuba salmon focused restoration projects. We've got meadow focused restoration projects, big forest health focused restoration projects. You know, fire and fire resiliency, especially in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, is a constant concern and conversation. And then we've also grown into a really robust education department as well, where we're out in classrooms doing educational work in classrooms, but also doing educational work, getting students outside on rivers, seeing salmon spawning, that kind of thing. And then, you know, trying to make sure that the change in the work that we're doing has a lasting impact through sort of advocacy and policy work, you know, in Sacramento. And again, a lot of that is getting politicians, getting policymakers, decision makers, folks from state, federal agencies out on the ground on projects, kind of seeing the work that we're doing and all the partners that we're working with to get this good work done. And so that's kind of, you know, what Circle is as an organization, what we're doing. What drew me to the organization initially was the location. You know, my wife and I met as raft guides, you know, out of Paloma, California, you know, many years ago, I don't know, 20 or so years ago. And so we knew the area, we knew we liked the area. So, you know, geography is important. It's important to, for me at least, to really love and enjoy where I live. And then I liked that there was, at that point, this kind of, it was about to get really big in terms of the amount of work that we were doing, that Circle was doing. And I was really excited about the opportunity to help sort of manage some of those projects, shape some of those projects, and keep that momentum going. And so when I talk about these salmon restoration projects, we're talking about, you know, 50 to 150 acres of new rearing habitat for Chinook and steelhead. You know, we're talking about lowering floodplains, removing, depending on the project, hundreds of thousands to more than 1 million cubic yards of hydraulic mining debris that's preventing the river from accessing what should be the floodplain, planting, you know, 10,000, 15,000 willows to kind of jumpstart some of that revegetation growth. And so when I first started, those projects were what was really exciting. And it was, you know, a good combination of kind of some of the work experience and project management experience that I'd had while in grad school. And my research was very much focused on the interactions between channel and river form and gravel size distribution, those kinds of things. And so it was a natural marriage, or it felt like a very natural fit in a place that already kind of felt like home.
Yeah. No, that makes perfect sense how that all comes together. And it's cool you met your wife too, doing the guide thing. I sort of have a similar story to that, but we'll say that for another day. But that's really cool. So I'm trying to think, because there's so many different, you know, things that you do and so many different ways that you connect with the community, from the education festivals, the restoration stuff. But when it comes to the restoration kind of specifically, like how do y'all kind of identify those different projects that need to be done, and not only identify them, but then figure out how to get them done to obviously better the area? And then is it more of a team of everybody like yourself, that kind of maps out that plan? And then is it kind of like a call for volunteers to kind of help, you know, those bigger projects that, you know, you kind of need the people power to go through? Or kind of like, what does that sort of look like?
Yeah, it varies a little bit depending on what kind of project we're talking about. So a meadow project versus salmon restoration versus forest health, just sort of the pace, the scale, the needs for the work are all a little bit different. But some of the consistent themes are that we do a really good job as an organization working with broad, diverse partners, and are pretty good at building bridges and working with partners that at face value may or may not seem like a logical partner. So a couple examples of that, in the Lower Yuba, one of the most crucial partners that we work with, you know, and the business is varied depending on the location, but is local aggregate mines. You know, when we're trying to remove 1.5 million yards of gravel from a floodplain, that gravel has to go someplace, and it's really expensive to move rock. And so by partnering with organizations that can monetize that for concrete, for road base, for landscaping rock, for any number of projects that are needed, we can lower costs and, you know, save tens of millions of dollars on construction for that habitat. We've got a good relationship with Yuba Water Agency as well. You know, they're certainly a partner. They're very focused, and we work with them really closely on a lot of our Lower Yuba restoration projects and some of our forest health projects as well. You know, we very much understand that in some ways we don't agree on 100% of things, but in a lot of ways, more water, healthier streams, healthier rivers benefits everybody. And lowered floodplains decrease flood risk. Healthier forests decrease flood risk. They decrease fire risk. And so there's, you know, we really rally together well around, you know, those shared causes. You know, in terms of how those projects get started, and it works the same for, you know, all of our projects, meadows, forest health, and then salmon stuff, we're looking at where is their need? Are there target species? Where is there places that there's a significant degradation of some sort of ecosystem niche that we want that we can get into and actually do something positive with? And so looking at degradation, looking at sort of long-term sustainability of a project, and then looking at land ownership as well is a big one, right? It's on the Lower Yuba, we've got great relationships with a lot of large privately held properties. And so we can go in, we can do restoration and then get out, and they've got, you know, restored habitat. They're getting some value out of that. In the upper portion of the watershed, frequently it's the Tahoe National Forest. There's some private property, some combinations, you know, land trusts where there's a need for restoration work, and we can kind of come in and say, okay, we're going to bring these partners together. We're going to bring, you know, maybe it's PG&E, you know, who are the adjacent landowners? What are the communities around these parcels? Let's bring them together. Let's talk about what we're doing, you know, and really build that coalition that we can do to get the work done. Depending on the scale of the project, sometimes, especially in meadows, it's smaller and we can do more hand tool based projects. So building beaver dam analogs or pole assisted log structures, you know, and that's pretty low impact work. A small group of guys or, you know, people with hand tools can spend a few weeks in a meadow and kind of get it moved towards a healthier direction, a little bit more sustainable direction, spreading water out and go in a couple of times and their work is done. Some of the other projects, you know, it takes a long time and a lot of effort to move, 350,000 million cubic yards of gravel by hand. And so that's where we're partnering. We're working, you know, applying for federal grants, applying for state grants. We've been fortunate that we've been pretty successful getting those to move that rock. And that's big yellow, you know, heavy equipment working as fast as they can to pull gravel out of the floodplain during the summer construction season. So we're not sort of negatively impacting any of the habitat, and then getting it to a place where it can get processed and sold again to offset project costs. So it's a, you know, a better deal for the state of California and the, you know, the taxpayers that ultimately help support that this work.
Yeah. And obviously it's cool that you have, you know, the good relationships with, you know, other organizations, businesses and that kind of stuff where it benefits everybody one way or the other, even the private landowners, you know, they want their land to be nice. And it's almost like, you know, it sounds like a lot of what you're doing, you know, like the gravel example, for instance, you know, it's not the case of cleaning up trash specifically. It's more of, you know, it's kind of what nature is kind of putting there, but it's also not helping, you know, it kind of stay vitalized in that sense. So you guys are kind of rebuilding it that way. So I, with it being springtime now, as we're recording this, I was thinking about a little, spring cleaning, nature's mess. Yep. In a way.
Yeah. You know, and a lot of it, the Yuba was hugely impacted by the gold rush. And we're still feeling that now, you know, the practice of hydraulic mining was invented in this watershed. And so, you know, that legacy of that damage is really what we're trying to kind of undo and give all of the different sort of environmental systems a chance to kind of restart, reset, adjust, and then the space to kind of self-manage or adjust as the climate continues to change. You know, I talk about removing gravel in the lower Yuba, you know, and that's all gold rush era gravel, you know, hundreds of millions of cubic yards of gravel got washed down into the lower Yuba and deposited, burying the ancestral floodplain. And, you know, depending on where you're standing, 40 to 80 feet of gravel. And so, wow. You know, it's really, you know, trying to kind of find some new balance. And then, like I said, give the river, the meadow, the forest, the space and the sort of patience, you know, human patience to adjust as the climate changes, because, you know, what these systems looked like 200 years ago is not what they're going to look like in 20. Because, you know, temperatures are going to change, rainfall regimes are going to change. And so letting them kind of self-adjust to whatever the new normal is really an important part in kind of how we think about our restoration and focusing on process rather than some sort of static done design.
Yeah, no. And yeah, no, sounds very thorough in that sense. And obviously super, important to kind of maintain and kind of can kind of keep it self-sufficient in a sense, you know, for the years to come. And so that kind of sort of sounds like, you know, kind of ties into the educational aspect, because, getting, you know, younger people kind of involved and understanding, you know, obviously that's growing the next generation of people like yourself to, you know, to kind of pass the torch to in a sense. So what are some of those kind of specific kind of educational pieces that you all do? Is it stuff with schools or different programs, or like kind of what does that look like?
Yeah, so we've both. We've got a couple of different things. I'll kind of talk about it. Two of the, I don't want to say coolest. I like all of them, but a couple of the best ones, or certainly ones that have the best story, are water quality monitoring and just general river monitoring. So we've got a volunteer-based water quality monitoring program that's 20, I think we're moving this, we just started year 23 or maybe 24.
Wow.
That's all volunteer-based, but over the last handful of years, we've been working really closely with a couple of the local high schools, getting those students out. They're helping with the water quality monitoring, but there's also, depending on the class and the age, you know, you're looking at that data, collecting that data. So there's sort of data collection, there's data analysis, there's a lot of room for conversation about statistics and how do you analyze that data? You know, is the measurement an outlier? Is it interesting? Is it not? Is it normal? You know, and then you can look at change through time and talk about sort of, well, you know, this action happened or there was this construction project. What are we learning? How can we kind of take external factors and help inform what we're seeing in the data? So that's a really exciting program that we're doing in a few schools. And then the other one that's really cool, every fall we do salmon expeditions with largely fourth graders, although we get a few other classes and we're, you know, working to expand. And so that's taking, again, with support from Yuba Water Agency, just about every fourth grader in the lower Yuba, largely Yuba County, out on the lower Yuba River during the fall on a raft trip to look at the salmon spawning. It's about a half day trip. We've got trained naturalists, you know, circle staff, phenomenal raft guides that help us get down. And not that it's a hard river, you know, it's sort of class one minus, but that get us, you know, get everybody down. And so we're talking about the indigenous tribes in the area. We're talking about the history of the gold rush. We're talking about the salmon life cycle. At this point, we're floating into restoration projects, you know, that we've done and talking about here's, you know, the restoration project. This is what it used to look like on the other side of the river. You know, why is it, what do we see? Is it different? You know, is it better? Is it worse? Having all of those conversations and, you know, watching salmon swim, watching them spawn, watching them rear, watching that portion of the life cycle in real time. I mean, I can't say enough good things about the program. It's so fun to get out there. It's so exciting. You know, we do a couple of community trips as well, but mostly it's targeted at local school-aged children. For a lot of them, it's the first time they've been on the river. It's the first time they've seen that and experienced, you know, the river as this sort of natural, healthy place rather than, you know, the kind of, you know, corridor through an urban center that it is, you know, a little bit further downstream as it flows into town.
Yeah, that's really cool. And especially, you know, as you mentioned, you know, it's some of those kids' kind of first opportunity to kind of experience in that way. And it's, you know, I'm sure it's a lot of excitement. You know, it's one thing to read about that in a science book in class or whatnot, but, you know, actually hands on and see it for yourself and do those things probably, you know, helps garner a lot of interest. And with you all, you know, you mentioned, you know, the one kind of program being on, you know, for over 23 years or almost 23 years. Are there like any, I guess, like stories of like people, like maybe it was a kid that started in the first one and now they're involved really big into the outdoors in a sense, like where it's kind of carried on. I feel like there might be some hidden stories there, but I'm not sure.
You know, I'm sure there are. So the student portion of some of that river monitoring is a couple years old. We also, you know, has been going on for a handful of years. So we are, and same thing with the salmon expeditions. So we are just starting to see the first groups of kids that we got out doing some of that river monitoring stuff, that we got out doing some of those salmon expeditions. We're just at a point where can start to see, I think this year might be the first year actually, where they'll be eligible for our student environmentalist scholarship, which is, I think, $4,000 for college bound students interested in, you know, something related to the environment. And so I think we're just getting to a point where we're really starting to see that. I mean, we certainly hear those stories and, you know, I've heard wonderful things from previous scholarship winners and know a couple of, you know, people that are here that, you know, went on a trip and are now volunteering at our trash cleanups and with the film festival and with all of those other things. And so they are certainly out there. They're certainly coming. And I think we're a couple years away from our first, like, oh yeah, I did that salmon expedition and now I'm a whatever fish biologist for California Department of Fish and Wildlife or something like that. You know, it's just, we need a couple more years for people to finish their, you know, finish their education. Then they, you know, of course, let us know if you've been one of those and you're listening, let us know.
That's awesome though. And it's cool. You know, you mentioned kind of the scholarship and that stuff too. You know, you know, you're not just offering kind of the program or whatnot, you know, you kind of help follow them through in a sense, that way and, you know, ultimately keep them involved in the outdoors one way or the other. So that's really cool. And then kind of one other thing I want to kind of talk about is the film festival that you mentioned. Is that more of a a larger kind of type community event? Like, because it sounds like that can give a lot of opportunity for sort of in a same sense as the educational aspect, with the kids getting to experience things that way. But even adults and other kids you're showing during that time and what's going on, to kind of maybe help them think about the outdoors and their natural kind of place that they, explore in a different way. So like, what is that kind of what that does, or kind of what more specifically, what does that look like?
Yeah, no, I think you're certainly on the right track. So it's, we host the sort of the Home Fest, the big Wild and Scenic Film Festival. It's February of every year. So just missed this year, but 13th through 17th, 2025. So it's a multi-day festival, depending on the year, between 110 and 120 different films from around the world.
Wow.
All with, we haven't quite settled on the theme for next year, but the idea, the tagline is, the Wild and Scenic Film Festival, where activism gets inspired. And so, it's a little different flavor of Film Fest than like your Banff Mountain Film Fest, where it's, you're going to see a lot of Red Bull helmets. There's a little bit of that, but we're more interested in stories of activism, stories of environmentalism, stories that inspire. And so, we see lots of different films, and the topics vary, right? A lot of sort of regenerative agriculture stuff this last year, indigenous communities around the world, taking control of their lands, advocating and fighting for protection of those places that are sacred to them. And then there's a lot of sort of, differently abled folks, kind of figuring out how to engage in the outdoor space, climbing while blind, or, how do you get up some of these trails if, walking isn't how you get around, those kinds of things. And so really it's focused on activism and inspiration. And so, like I said, it's a multi-day festival here in Nevada City in February, and then we send it out on tour. We're in, 60, maybe 100 cities across the country, and, different sister organizations, other like-minded organizations like us will host the tour, and it's a film festival in a box kind of thing is the model. And so if you've got an organization that's looking for a fundraiser, this is a great opportunity. We hear a lot of positive things about it. It's certainly a revenue generator. That's how it started for us, was as a revenue source. And so it goes out, and folks can, pick the films that they're interested in. We've got educational programming that we do with some of the films for schools, if you want to get into your local school as well, that goes with it, if other organizations anywhere are interested in that. And so, it's big. And it ties into our education department and ties closely into the restoration work that we're doing as well. And, sits kind of around the organization is kind of key to where we are and what we do.
Yeah, that's really cool, because for those that might not be as involved in the outdoors in that sense, it kind of lets them have a glimpse into what that looks like, depending on what the topics are and stuff, or the theme is of that year. And it's really cool too that after you do it there sort of locally, expanding it out that way, inspiring others that are kind of outside of your community in that sense to, take hold of their own environment that they're living in the outdoors and help protect and restore and everything like that. So that sounds like a really cool program, kind of mixed with everything else that you all are doing. And I know we covered a bunch of different kind of topics and stuff like that. Is there anything that I might have overlooked or forgot to ask you as far as what you all do before we wrap things up?
Boy, we have touched on a lot, and I think that's a function of how many different kinds of work we do. I think the other big thing that is worth mentioning, we're also the Yuba River Water Keeper. So in addition to the Circle name, in addition to the Wild and Scenic Film Festival, we're part of the International Waterkeeper Alliance. So we're the Yuba River Waterkeeper, which is a great organization to be part of. It gives us, a little bit of weight, a little bit of sort of gravitas when we're in DC or we're in Sacramento, sort of advocating for small policies or funding for the environment, education, whatever it is. Building those relationships as well in through our sort of advocacy policy work, trying to make sure that, not only is the Yuba healthy, but we've got smart decisions, smart policies that really reflect the challenges that we face here in the West and, California, especially in terms of, water and climate change and fire and all of those different things that we're all dealing with already and will only continue to.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's cool, not that we have to deal with those problems, but it's cool that you're thinking of all aspects and all avenues, ultimately to kind of serve the purpose and, being able to touch a lot of different people, in different places in a sense, depending on kind of meeting them where they're at in a way, which is really cool. So one thing I always like to ask our guests is kind of one piece of advice that our listeners can take away. And I'm going to kind of circle a little bit back to the beginning of your story, but then also kind of how it ultimately ended up. And, you mentioned, a lot of kind of what contributed to kind of where you are today. And obviously the work that you're helping do and everything like that, started with, kind of looking at the outdoors in a different way, in a scientific way of exploring, rather than your parents say, "Oh, go play," and then come back, when it's dinner time, or those mm-hmm. typical stories. What would you say to, a parent that might do that? Maybe they live out in the country and they can just send the kids out and play around. But what would you say to that parent to help encourage and kind of spark that interest in different way of looking at the outdoors, kind of in that scientific way, that will help kind of create those or spark that interest and curiosity and that want to protect the environment in that sense, and maybe ultimately lead down a path such you have?
Yeah, I think. Why is the best question there is? If you see something and you don't really understand it, asking why is a great question. And, I recognize that there can be too many why questions. can certainly appreciate that. But there are some of those questions, maybe a few of those questions are worth time and thought and explore it together. Why is a great question. And I think the other thing that I'll say is, I don't know is a great answer, yeah. And that's so much of that. Even if you do know, but you want to sort of figure it out together and encourage that curiosity. So, your kid asks, why is the sky blue? Or could it ever rain Coke? don't give them the answer or don't pull it up on your phone real quick. It's, gee, I don't know. Let's figure that out together. Let's explore it together. And it doesn't have to be about the outdoors. Maybe it's, maybe it's about art. Maybe it's about history. Maybe engineering, what does a carburetor do? Like, I don't know. Let's figure it out together. And so those are, I think, the great questions to ask and to encourage that curiosity.
Yeah, I love that too. And that's such a good point, especially in today's day and age, as far as, a kid ask you a question, you're like, oh yeah, I'll just Google it real quick and I'll figure it out. But to encourage that creativity by you being interested in helping them figuring out the answer, as you mentioned, whether you do know it or you don't know it at the time they ask. But no, I think that's excellent piece of advice and creates that creativity, regardless what the space is, whether it's outdoors, art, anything in between. So to that point, where can people find you online, follow you, get involved if they're around the area, learn more about all the mini programs that you all do?
Yeah, absolutely. So our website is yubariver.org, yubariver.org. And we're on, Facebook, we're on Instagram as well. And then for the film festival, if you're curious about that specifically, it's wildandscenicfilmfestival.org. And again, also, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, those kinds of things as well. You can get a lot of content there. I think those are the great places to follow us. And if, you know, you're in the Nevada City, Grass Valley, Sacramento, you know, Truckee, you're anywhere close, and you want to come up, lend a hand, help out, see a little bit more what we're about, I'd certainly welcome everybody to come visit. We got volunteer events from trash pickups to, you know, usher roles at the film festival. Frequently there's opportunities to do either plantings of native species in meadows, or in the lower Yuba, we've got opportunities for, God, what else is coming up? Installing fencing around aspen groves to keep grazing out of those aspen stands where they regenerate. I think those are the ones that are coming up. And a couple of, you know, fun events coming up. We've got our State of the Yuba event next month in April, and then a really fun sort of more gala fundraiser in June, Wild for the Yuba. So if you're in the area or don't mind a little bit of a drive, there's also plenty of opportunities to come up, learn more, and get involved.
Awesome. Everybody, definitely make sure you're checking them out. Give them a follow. Like you said, get involved if you can. Definitely a lot of different unique ways to get involved in that sense as well. But I appreciate you coming on and sharing your story and everything you're doing for the Yuba River and everything around the area. And I wish you all the best of luck.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was great to get on and chat with you.
Thanks for listening. And hey, if you've made it this far and like what you've heard, go ahead and hit that subscribe button and let your friends know about Life in Motion. Until next time.